Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Anne Wright. Wright attended the University of Arkansas, where she received a master's and a law degree. She also has a master's degree in national security affairs from the U.S. Naval War College. She spent 13 years in the U.S. Army and 16 in the Army Reserves, retiring as a colonel. In 1987, Wright joined the Foreign Service and served as U.S. Deputy Ambassador in such places as Sierra Leone, Micronesia, and Afghanistan. In March of 2003, on the eve of the invasion of Iraq, Wright resigned from her State Department post in protest. She's been speaking out against the war ever since. She also recently published a book called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, Government Insiders Speak Out Against the War in Iraq, published by Koa Books. I'm speaking to Anne Wright by phone from the airport in Oakland, California. Anne Wright, thank you so much for joining us on Out of Bounds.
Sure.
Now, I want to talk to you about the fact that you joined the U.S. Army right after college. What attracted you to a life in the military?
Well, I was not really attracted to a life of the military. I joined the military because I wanted to get away from something. I had grown up in the state of Arkansas, and I desperately wanted to get out of Arkansas. And so I, like many young men and women of today, in a time of an unpopular war, I joined during Vietnam. The military was a vehicle for me to get out of Arkansas, to get some job experience, to earn the GI Bill, and to put me in a place where I could go on with further education later. And even though it was during a very unpopular war, I figured I didn't have to go to Vietnam and shoot anybody, but it was a mechanism for me to attain other goals. And that's the same thing that happens with a lot of kids today. They don't want to go shoot anyone, but they need to get out of their family environment, or they need an opportunity for schooling that they don't have now. So the military is a release valve for many people in that way.
Mm-hmm. Now tell us what your first thoughts were after 9/11, and tell us where you were.
On 9/11, I was at my home, at the time was in Hawaii. I was in a special assignment for the State Department, working in the office of the governor of the state of Hawaii on an international conference that was coming up there. And I turned on the TV early in the morning after a phone call from a friend on the East Coast saying, "You better get up and watch this. It's wild, terrible things are happening." And to see the buildings, the Twin Towers, and then the Pentagon, and then the plane that went into the Pennsylvania farmlands. I mean, they're just horrible images that we all saw.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, initially, you agreed with the Bush administration's first response to this by they went into Afghanistan after 9/11. Now, tell us why you agreed with this.
Well, I felt that the United States did need to take some action against the perpetrators of those four horrible attacks on the United States. And I felt that going after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, I mean, that's where we figured they were located, and go after them there was appropriate. On further reflection, you know, and as now 6 years, almost 7 years have gone by since 9/11, it appears to me that perhaps there would have been a better response than a military response, that indeed virtually all the people who have committed terrorist acts around the world have not been captured through military operations. They've been captured by law enforcement techniques and methods, and they've been brought to trial in federal courts. And I think that it has its challenges in this case, because at the same time, I think the issue of the Taliban in Afghanistan is another issue that arose for the United States of can an occupying force rid the country of a group that has been very brutal to its own population. So by the military occupation, one could argue that one was trying to help the people of Afghanistan by getting rid of a very brutal regime. However, as we see now, the Taliban has regrouped in Pakistan and is coming back in great numbers, very well trained and with lots of equipment, and are staging major military operations against NATO and American forces.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were absolutely incredulous when you began to hear President Bush talk about his campaign into Iraq. So tell us about how you were feeling about that.
Well, it started when I was in Afghanistan, and with the State of the Union message that President Bush made in January of 2002, where he said there were other countries of interest besides Afghanistan, that Iran, Iraq, North Korea, the axis of evil, those countries were of great concern to the United States. And for those of us that were sitting in Kabul, Afghanistan at the time, when we were listening to this on a satellite television, and we all kind of went, oh, my God, no wonder we are not getting the types of military forces that we thought we would probably have in Afghanistan, and that the economic development programs that we thought would really be moving very quickly into the country had been very slow. And so we all kind of looked at each other and went, there's something else afoot with the president talking about those three countries, and yet you've got a major, major military operation going on right now in Afghanistan, and he's talking about other countries. And as we find out from the Downing Street memos, the memorandum that were created by the very senior members of the Tony Blair government, as they were approached by senior-level officials of the Bush administration back in 2002, the U.S. officials were asking British officials, their Minister of Defense, their head of their equivalent of the CIA, to consider going into Iraq, to invade and occupy Iraq. And the Brits, as they write in their memos, called the Downing Street memos, said that there was no real legal basis for an invasion by the U.S. and the Brits, that they would have to fix the intelligence in order to create a basis for going in.
Now, you finally took drastic measures, and you were a deputy ambassador in Mongolia at the time in March of 2003, and you cabled your letter of resignation because of this.
Well, that's right. I had been a government employee for almost 35, 40 years. I served in 8 different presidential administrations, starting with Lyndon Johnson when I first joined the military, and then all the way up through George W. Bush. So I had seen a lot of programs that were unpopular, illegal, a lot of programs that the American public had protested against, and yet I had stayed in the government. I always tried to find myself a position that I felt like I was doing good for people, that I wasn't harming anyone, and that even though there may have been unpopular policies and programs that were going on during whatever administration it was, that I wasn't personally involved in it and could feel like that I was being a good public servant. And, of course, people can always question you on that, and they well should, because there were some pretty illegal things that were going on in some of these administrations, and other people did resign, but I didn't. And that's why right now, when there were only 3 of us that resigned over the war in Iraq, I mean, and our common theme of our letters of resignation, although the 3 of us did not know each other, but we all wrote a lot of the same things of the illegality of a war, of the invasion and occupation of a country that had not done anything to us, and particularly an oil-rich Arab Muslim country, that the outrage of the region and of the world was going to be very dangerous for the United States.
Now, you actually had 4 reasons in your letter of resignation. Talk about, besides the war in Iraq, you were worried about the lack of effort to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Tell us a little about that.
Well, that conflict right there, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is, in my opinion, the basic cause of a lot of the turmoil in the whole Middle Eastern region. And until that issue is resolved, that the state of Israel is able to live in peace and that the Palestinians have a country of their own, until that is resolved, there will be such great tensions in the region that all sorts of very dangerous things will be happening. And I felt the Bush administration had done nothing, and this was like by March of 2003, nothing to quell the fires that were going on in that conflict. And if you remember back, that was the Enfitada, that was the second one, really, and the Bush administration was really not using any of its available pressure on either side to get them to get both sides to back off and to stop the senseless killing of civilians, of the young Palestinian suicide bombers going in and blowing up cafes filled with Israelis, and then the Israeli military going in and just bulldozing down villages of Palestinians. And the Bush administration just sat back and was doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt the administration did need to use its leverage there.
One of the other points that you made in your letter of resignation was the lack of policy in North Korea. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Well, it kind of in the same way, the Bush administration was not following up at all on any of the progress that had made by the previous administration, the Clinton administration. And here there had been a lot of groundwork laid. There were some programs that were going that I felt the Bush administration really need to move ahead on, because North Korea, its isolation and the instability of its leader, I would think the safest thing is to engage them and not hold them at arm's length. And at the time, the North Koreans were kind of lashing out at the world for being held at arm's length and being purposely isolated by the Bush administration. They were accosting vessels at sea. They were sending missiles over Japan. They were doing everything to signal in very dramatic ways that they wanted the international community, and particularly the United States, to start talking to their government.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, the Bush administration did join a multinational dialogue with them, and that now that's turned into a bilateral dialogue. But when I resigned, none of this had happened. The Bush administration was still saying they were going to study the problem, and that was it. And I felt that was dangerous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, another concern of yours that you mentioned in your letter of resignation, which I find quite interesting, was that you were really concerned about the unnecessary policies curtailing rights in this country.
Well, that's right. The Patriot Act had needlessly curtailed lots of civil liberties that are the foundation of our own country. And while I certainly understand the need for tighter security in some areas, and having been a government employee, I had some suggestions for him on some places that I felt we could tighten up a bit, but still not undermine the basic rights that we have of freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, and the right to know what charges are that are placed against us, and the right not to be picked up and held incommunicado. And you could say, well, that didn't happen, but there were lots of cases of that was happening right after 9/11 and the Patriot Act, and it can happen right now. I mean, I am even more fearful now, 7 years later, about these unnecessary curtailments of civil liberties than I was then. Mm-hmm. When you think of all of the things that are going on, and the book that I've just written, Dissent: Voices of Conscience. Well, a lot of people have been speaking out against the various aspects of the Bush administration's policies, and boy, things have come down hard and heavy on them. For example, for me, I do a lot of protesting up in Washington, and although I'd never been arrested one time in my life until September of 2005, during the big anti-war demonstration in Washington, arrested in front of the White House, sitting down on a sidewalk, peaceful, nonviolent protest of administration policies. Since then, I've been arrested numerous times, but all on misdemeanors, never a felony, and never for anything violent. Well, now I find myself on the FBI's National Crime Information Center database.
Really?
Which is supposed to be for hardened felons, for fugitives, for sex offenders, for violent gang members. And now I, as a peaceful, nonviolent protester, am on the list. And the way I found out about it, I was going up to a conference in Ottawa, Canada, and the immigration officer scanned my passport and said, "Have you ever been convicted of anything?" And I kind of looked at him and went, "Well, I sat down in front of the White House one time and got convicted of violating an ordinance. And, well, I have been in Congress, and I've stood up and said something in Congress, and yes, I was arrested and convicted of a violation of a misdemeanor." He said, "I'm sorry, you can't come to Canada." And I said, why? And he said, well, you're on this list, and we don't let convicted felons in. I said, I'm not a felon. I'm a misdemeanor-er.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, it is. It surely is. And when you have that sort of action, which is, in my opinion, pure political intimidation of any sort of dissent, that is what really frightens me about these curtailments of civil liberties.
Now, there is something called the dissent channel in the military and in government. Tell us about that, and did you use that dissent channel?
In the State Department, it is called the dissent channel, and it's a mechanism that is available to employees to circumvent, go around the entire chain of command, that you as a person out, say, in the U.S. Embassy in Mongolia, and you've got concerned about some policy, and in fact I did, the policies of going to war in Iraq. And if you feel like by putting your concerns up through the chain of command, they will never, ever get to the top dogs that are making these policy decisions, that you can go around your immediate boss and the next boss and the next boss and send something straight to Colin Powell. Well, that's what I did. And essentially it was the guts of my resignation letter went forward first as a dissent channel table to Colin Powell. And of course you use that channel at your peril, even though they say that there's no retaliation taken against anyone that puts something up through the dissent channel. People always find out about it, and sometimes your immediate bosses may not be happy that you have not gone through them before you go straight to the Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm. And did you get any kind of a response from Colin Powell when you sent this to him?
Well, it was answered actually through the policy committee of the State Department. They are the ones that are charged with answering the cables that concerned policies. And what I received was pretty much what the public affairs dump for the day was from the Bush administration on why going to war in Iraq was good for the United States and good for international security. It really didn't enlighten me at all. It didn't give me any solace that my concerns had been addressed at all.
Then there was a lot of demonization of dissenters following the invasion. What did you say to people who called you a traitor or called you un-American?
Well, quite honestly, I really didn't get much of that. And I don't know whether it was because when people do say that, all I have to say is, well, I was in the military 29 years and I was 16 years as a diplomat. And my whole life I have been in service to our country. That pretty well diffuses their comments, because most of the people that will call you a traitor and un-American have never been in the military and have never been serving in the government. So I really haven't had too much of that. Every now and then, like Bill O'Reilly, I was on his show one time, and at the end of the show he was ranting, and, you know, you're un-American, you hate your country, you do this and that. And so I just said, well, Bill, I was in the military 29 years and a diplomat for 16. What did you do? And that's when he said, cutter Mike, cutter Mike. And
no kidding. Oh, God. So people haven't said that you signed on as a military person and you should just follow orders no matter what.
Well, the military itself has its own professional way of handling things. And when I was in the military, your responsibility was to your unit and to your superior officers, that if you felt something was going wrong, you had better speak up. Because if things went sour and you had the answer to this, then you were going to be in big trouble because you didn't speak up. And I think there's probably been a change in approaches under this administration. I think the Bush administration does intimidate people, and in the military itself, we've got senior officers now who have retired who are now speaking very publicly, saying, I wish I had had the courage to do what I knew I should have as a military professional, to have stated before the war that this is going to be a disaster for the United States, a disaster for our military, and we must not do this.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly one three-star general, a Marine general, Gregory Newbolt, who at the time was the director of operations for the Joint Staff. He now says that he really regrets that he did not stand up to say this is wrong.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of people do by now. Now, Anne, do you have any idea at this point in time why the Bush administration invaded Iraq?
Well, you know, we all know the various ideas that they put forward. Mm-hmm. You know, first the weapons of mass destruction, and then to have a democratic country in the region that could be the foundation for other democratization efforts in the region. Of course, they don't say the three-letter word called oil.
Mm.
And quite honestly, at first, I just couldn't think that we surely weren't invading an occupying country just to get its oil. But if you look at some of the things that really have happened, some of the Paul Bremer's, I can't remember what we call that.
Oh, yeah, he was the viceroy of the...
Yeah, when he was the viceroy. You know, some of the very first people that he brought in were oil company executives to be his advisors on what to do about the oil. They were the ones that actually wrote this very controversial proposed law on, I think they call it the hydrocarbon law rather than the oil and gas law.
Mm.
But what that law, which has not been enacted by the Iraqi parliament, much to the chagrin of the Bush administration, and in fact last summer the Bush administration said that one of the benchmarks for evaluating how well the Iraqi government was doing and whether or not the United States would provide further reconstruction funds for the country was whether or not the Iraqi parliament was going to pass this hydrocarbon law. And the law actually states that for all undiscovered oil, but everybody knows where the undiscovered oil is. It's right beneath the surface. Iraq has some of the most easily accessible oil in the world. And there's plenty of it. They know where it is, but they just haven't tapped into it. Well, the Bush administration wants this law passed that international oil consortiums, primarily the United States, would have sweetheart deals on that undiscovered oil. And the Iraqis are refusing to pass this because that's their treasure. They don't have much else there. Sand is not one of the great commodities of the international world financial markets, but mm-hmm. that oil surely is.
Mm.
So the administration is pushing hard to get that law passed, and for 3.5 years, the Iraqis have said, no, we're not passing it.
Hmm. Now, tell us what directions you've taken in your protest against the war since you resigned. What groups are you working with?
Well, I work with just about any group at all that has as its mission stopping the war in Iraq and preventing a war with Iran, to hold accountable the Bush administration for its violations of international and domestic law on torture, on eavesdropping, on rendition. I work a lot with Veterans for Peace as a veteran. I work with Code Pink Women for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
I work with the Iraq Veterans Against the War, the Raging Grannies, the Granny Peace Brigade, you name it, and I'm right there with them.
I heard that you did a protest at Guantanamo as well.
Yes, we did. In fact, at this time last year, we were in Guantanamo, right outside the back gates of the U.S. Naval Base, just out in the outskirts of the city of Guantanamo. I was part of an international delegation who had gone down there to commemorate the end of the fifth year of that prison being in operation. We had with us the mother and brother of a prisoner, Omar Dagayas, who was released just in December of this last year, 11 months after we were at the back gates of Guantanamo last year.
Hmm.
We also had with us a young man who had been released in 2004 and who was brave enough, courageous enough to come back to Cuba to talk to the international media about his treatment there and to talk to Cubans about what was going on their soil.
Hmm. Now, do you see any possibility for a positive outcome here?
Well, I think as long as the United States is an occupying force in Iraq, that there will never be peace there.
Hmm.
I just can't see how you can have peace through occupation. I mean, the Iraqis are telling us with every bullet, with every suicide bomber, that they don't want us there. And I think the only way that things will ever resolve themselves is when the United States moves out. And if the Iraqi government, the Iraqi people, want further international security assistants, let them pick who they want to have in there to help them. And probably it won't be the United States. Each one of the factions in Iraq, each one is allied with groups in the region, and it's they who have to come to grips with how they want their country. And I would submit that as long as the United States has forces there, and the U.S. military is saying, well, we anticipate we're going to have forces there for the next 30 years. Even the Iraqi Minister of Defense, who was in the United States last week, was saying that he was requesting that the United States have troops in there to at least the year 2018, I believe it was. So it looks like most people are saying the U.S. is going to be in there for a long time, and yet the violence will continue. Right now there is a lessening of it. Some people say it's the surge that is causing the lessening of the violence. I hope it holds, but I have a sneaking suspicion this is a response to the actually the buying off of people fighting against the United States, short-term purchase of their stopping shooting at us, but whenever they want to, they'll start shooting at us again, having bought more weapons and ammunition with the money that we have given them. And when you see neighborhoods that have now been ethnically cleansed, that you have very few mixed neighborhoods of Sunni and Shia living together, now they've been separated, and in many places in Baghdad, separated with walls that have been built up. So that does not seem to me like it is the long-term solution to peace for the country of Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, we're almost out of time, and did you have any regrets at all about what you did?
No, I have no regrets at all. I am very content with my decision. In fact, if I were still working in the government, I think I would have had triple ulcers and probably had a heart attack. And I don't know how people are continuing to work in this administration with all of the illegal criminal acts that are being committed by many of the departments of our government. The Justice Department, the FBI, State Department's been doing some sneaky little stuff too. Department of Defense with torture, CIA with torture. I don't know. People do compartmentalize things a lot, but I'm afraid that all of those things would have worn me down. So I am very glad I made the decision, as tough as it was at the time on one level, but it was easy on the moral and ethical side of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ann Wright, thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you all so much for your interest in all of this.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.